This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
All right, let's get it going right here, right now. This is Diamond Conversations, and you're listening to episode 2 of Diamond Conversations on the Place to Be Podcasting Network. If you didn't know by now, my name is Chad, and every single week I will bring to you a brand new interview with somebody involved in the world of baseball, whether it is a ball player, a writer, a columnist, an announcer, a commentator, whatever you can find, we're going to have on this show to talk about the game we all love, the game of baseball that is in an absolute pivotal time in the season as we're approaching Game 3 of the World Series with the Nationals and the Houston Astros, which is a topic you'll get to hear about with my guest today on the program, former New York Mets minor league prospect TJ Chisholm, joining me for episode 2 here of Diamond Conversations. And during the years of 2009 to 2014, TJ Chisholm was a New York Mets pitching prospect. He was a middle relief specialist. He tells us everything about coming through the minor leagues with the Mets from draft day all the way through his final hours as a New York Met farmhand, and what it was that brought the Mets to releasing TJ in 2014. But in between, you hear a lot of cool stories about what it was like to be on the road there as a minor league ball player. You get to hear about stops in St. Lucie, you get to hear about stops in Brooklyn, and then obviously stops at the AA club in Binghamton, New York. Just if you're a Met fan, you know all these stops as being the breeding ground for the future of the franchise. And the future of the franchise then was the kind of current crop that we see on the field now, as you hear a lot of the players and a lot of the coaches that have much to do with the recent success of this past year of the New York Mets and also the 2015-2016 playoff campaigns. TJ got to play and got to be coached by a lot of the people in the Met infrastructure at the time. So don't discount some of these stories you're about to hear today if you're a Met fan, because it kind of gives you an idea as to what the organization was prior to Sandy Alderson coming in, because TJ was drafted in the Omar Minaya administration and then kind of was very successfully transitioned over into what would become the Sandy Alderson era, but then also kind of how Terry Collins would move on to become the manager of the Mets. So we kind of get an inside look and also a very interesting look from the lower tier, from what an incoming minor leaguer thought about the organization at that point in time, and just kind of how he blossomed and how he got to become a professional by being on the road and by checking out the different levels that the Mets sent him to. So a lot of cool stuff to cover in this episode with TJ Chisholm. He's going to tell you what he's doing today, and that is kind of really what the basis of this show was built off of, to see what's going on with guys after they retire. Where do you go from here? What do you do after baseball is over? And what do you do with your career? And TJ has a really sweet opportunity to do that now as a fundraising coordinator for an organization out of Philadelphia. And he will tell us all about that in the episode. And I really don't want to keep it too long here, but I just wanted to plug, if you do listen to the show on the Place to Be Podcasting Network, please head on over to Facebook. I just created a brand new page for this show, aptly titled Diamond Conversations, that I'd love for you to check out. I'd love for you to be a part of. Send me suggestions of guests that you want to see, topics you want covered, and you never know. I've had a great response to what's been posted so far, and I just only want to grow this. And, you know, I've done pro wrestling interviews for the last 5 years, and a couple into doing the baseball ones. I'm having an absolute ball, and I hope you enjoy them as well. So please reach out on Facebook. It's Diamond Conversations Baseball Podcast. The Place to Be Nation has obviously shared that for me, and I really appreciate that. And if you want to follow me on Twitter, please do so. It's at WrestlinPal, R-A-S-S-L-I-N-P-A-L. A lot of ties to the wrestling world. So at WrestlinPal on Twitter. And I really appreciate the support and really appreciate everybody who's listened so far. Stay tuned. Only more to come on Diamond Conversations. So let's wrap it up here nice and let's head on over to a wonderful little interview that I conducted with former New York Mets prospect TJ Chisholm. back into it here on Diamond Conversations. You're listening to episode 2 of Diamond Conversations here on the Place to Be podcast network. And so happy to be joined by former Mets minor league prospect today on the show. Obviously, you know, we're not too far into our run here on Diamond Conversations, but I'm a huge Mets fan, so this is going to be a lot of fun. And very proud to welcome in the one and only TJ Chisholm. TJ, thanks so much for joining me today.
Oh, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Oh, absolutely. Definitely want to get into what you're doing today, because it's one of the focuses of the show, is kind of learning what you do after your baseball days are over. But I got to ask you this, and this is just purely the Met fan in me coming out. How does somebody who grew up in Philadelphia get drafted by the Mets and be able to put that that animosity to the side while you're getting your playing days started?
It was definitely shocking with all the other teams out there and draft day. You know, we had heard a couple other teams. We heard Mariners and Yankees possibly, and then bang, it's the Mets. And I can't tell you how many of my buddies gave me so much crap. Growing up a Phillies fan, and it was just immediately, ask for a trade. I'm like, man, that's not how this works. You're like, I would have loved any team to draft me. And, you know, it being them who, growing up, you know, we kind of hated being Phillies fans, but it was a dream come true. Just the day to hear your name, and it could have been any team. And it was actually kind of funny that it was the Mets. It made me, you know, actually like them at the time, because I wanted nothing more than to come to Citizens Bank Park at that point and beat the Phillies, you know, in front of all my buddies. So it was definitely weird.
It's cool though, because at that point, that rivalry was pretty heated, you know, around the time you were drafted in 2009. And that was like, I don't know, that was almost at the height of that Met hate for the Philly fans and the Philly fans hating the Mets. So it was a pretty contentious time to be a Northeastern baseball fan.
Absolutely. And it was perfect because the Mets had choked that like 2007 and got us into the playoffs. they were up like, I don't know what it was, like 13 games in September. And
I think it was 17 with seven games with 17 to play or something like that.
Yeah, it was crazy. And there's actually pictures of me in college wearing a Mets hat, because every time I wore it, they would lose. So I wore it like 8 straight days, you know, wherever I was on campus, I was wearing it. And I still see pictures like on Facebook of me with a Mets hat. People are like, why are you wearing that? It was before you got drafted. And I have to explain to them, like, I wore this hat and we would win and the Mets would lose. So we kept doing it. And they got us in the playoffs that year.
Oh, my gosh. So it's your fault. That was amazing. That was 2007 and 2008. I mean, they were unbelievable teams and two cataclysmic collapses both of those years, and just watch the Phillies just those 3 years, 2007, 2008, and then obviously in 2009 just go on to some triumphant times in Philadelphia.
Yes, it was. I went to the parade in 08, and then 09 obviously sucked losing to the Yankees, but it was a great time. I mean, to be in college at LaSalle, which was, you know, a short train ride to the stadiums, we got down there as much as we could. It was a great time to be in the city.
Very cool. And Philly, obviously, in the news right now, they just brought on Joe Girardi to be their manager. And again, another chapter in that Mets-Phillies rivalry, because all the Met fans wanted Joe Girardi. And here he goes, and he signs in Philadelphia. The kind of style that you've seen out of Joe Girardi as an observer, do you think what he does fits the Philadelphia baseball model?
I think it will. I think he holds guys accountable, and that's something that I think was lacking a little bit. The last 2 years with Gabe, and you know, I'm not just talking about Herrera and guys like, you know, that don't hustle and all that stuff, but just off the field things that don't need to be distractions. And I don't think Girardi will allow that to happen. I don't know if he's going to implement that no facial hair. I know that he's a big component of that, and that kind of fell in his lap there in New York because they have that anyway.
Right.
But I don't know how that goes over. I know the Mets had it when I was in the minor leagues, and I hated it. And I never even grew this. And I just hated the fact that they could tell us not to grow it kind of thing. But I don't know how that'll go over. I think from a baseball standpoint, I mean, the guy's been around the game a long time and he knows, you know, everything there is to kind of know about managing. I know he can handle a bullpen better than Gabe Kapler can. So I'm looking forward to that. But yeah, I think, you know, he never won a World Series. Did he ever go to one? with the Yankees?
No, Girardi, they won the one world title.
Okay.
They have the one world championship, and I mean, he was there for 10 years. And if you're a manager for 10 years for the New York Yankees, you know, you obviously have done something right. And to be honest, I mean, really outside of the maybe 1 year, he always had a pretty good team. And, you know, you look back to the first year he had with the Marlins, you know, that was like the training ground, and he had a manager of the year award winner, inspired, you know, with the Marlins. Right? Yeah. And it was kind of a shocker that he was let go, but I think it'll be good for Philadelphia. Definitely different than Kapler, without a doubt. But you know, that division is packed, and everybody seems to be making a move here and there, and you know, it makes it tough. You know, to see, who can you predict at this point? I guess obviously we'll stick with the Braves, just because they're the champs. But you know, those Nats, those pesky
it's
Nationals.
Crazy, isn't it? The Nats were the one team we like weren't worried about. All you know, they got rid of Harper, no big deal. Like, they were the least of our worries. It was basically who's going to be there from the Braves and the Mets and the Phillies, and now these guys are in the World Series.
It's crazy. And I basically, so I live in the outside the Washington, D.C. area now, and, you know, I've sat here and I've killed them every series, being like, nope, you know, L.A. is going to take care of them. Nope, St. Louis is going to take care of them. Now there's no way they're getting past the Astros. And then it's like, all right, I'm tapping out and I'm not rooting anymore. So I just, you know what I'm rooting for? I'm rooting for February. I'm rooting for a spring training.
Yeah. Already looking forward to that. I hear you.
Absolutely. So why don't you tell us a little bit about when you got drafted in 2009 by the Mets. Around that time is when there was a little bit of a change in the regime. I think that might have been 2010 officially, but what was the culture like, and what was it like getting drafted by the New York Mets?
So yes, you're absolutely right. It was Omar Minaya was there in 2009. And I want to say it was either that year or the year after, but we were kind of hearing things about what him and another guy had done in AA. You know, they were losing games, or maybe it was AAA, one of them. We were just hearing things like, you know, you don't want to come across, oh, Tony Bernazar.
Yeah, Tony Bernazar, yep.
Yeah, we were hearing things. And this, you know, I'm young. I don't know anything. I'm just, yeah, you know, listening to the guys, and they're saying, you know, you don't want to come across Tony Bernazar. You know, they'll fine you $100 for having stubble and this and that. And it was kind of like we were scared almost, you know. And there was another guy in the organization, Adam Wogan. He was like the director of player development. And I remember my first day in Kingsport, Tennessee, like he came in our room and was like checking our room. And I'm like kind of like scared, you know, like I'm thinking I just got drafted. Like I'm a free, you know, this isn't college anymore. I'm free. You know, I'm an adult. I'm 20 years old, going to be 21. Like, you know, and it was kind of like that culture shock of like, am I really going to have a curfew? Am I like getting bed checked and all that stuff? And it was weird being, you know, an adult. And I get it, because there's kids on your team that are 17, that are 18, and, you know, they haven't really been away from home. So I understood it. But obviously it was awesome getting drafted and kind of going through that culture shock the first couple of years. And guys would tell us, you know, that had been there in AA, they said, you know, it gets better. Don't worry about it. Like, you don't have curfew in AA, AAA. So, you know, just get out of the low levels and you don't have to deal with that stuff anymore. And then that following year, when they kind of got out of there, that whole regime, and they kind of brought in Terry Collins, and he was our field coordinator for a year, and it was awesome. We absolutely loved the guy because he didn't make pitchers shag anymore. So in spring training, you would have a full morning, you know, from 7:30 to noon. You'd go in and eat, and then you'd come out. And if you weren't scheduled to pitch, then you had to shag, and you had to go to BP fields and chase down balls for 3 hours. And we hated it, but Terry didn't make us do it. He came in and said, "We're not paying you guys to go track down fly balls and tire yourself out. We're paying you guys to pitch." So, you know, there was days in spring training when I was home at like 1 o'clock. It was awesome.
Oh wow!
We absolutely loved Terry. Like, I wasn't surprised when he got the managerial job a couple years later. Like, it made sense. He was a player's coach, and those guys really fed off him. I mean, took him to a World Series, and he was a good dude. Like, I enjoyed it. But that kind of changed the culture a little bit. It wasn't like we were scared anymore. Like, you know, players were looking over their shoulders, you know. And it's funny, I can remember one time in spring training in 14, me, DeGrom, and a guy named Jeff Walters, who is a good buddy of ours, he actually had 38 saves in Binghamton 1 year, didn't get called up. But we're all in a stretch line, and we were all growing our hair out at the time. And one of the coaches, like, came over to us, and may have even been Dickie Scott, who was the field coordinator at the time. And he's like, you know, you guys got to cut your hair. It can't be past your shoulders. And Jake's obviously was. So the next day, like before spring training, that next morning, Jake is the only one that cuts his hair. So me and Walt, we just wet it a little bit and kind of made it, you know, scrunch up so it was above our shoulders. Jake was the only one to cut his hair. And a year later, he wins Rookie of the Year. I'm like thinking in my head, I'm like, you got told to cut your hair and now you are known for your hair. Like that is what people around the league, you know, fans, they recognize you as that. And they told you to cut it. Now you're known for it. It was just like a crazy turn of events within a year, you know, and they always told us like every guy that was, you know, had been to the big leagues and kind of came down and was in our groups for spring training or rehabs with us. They always say like, you do what they say when you're in the minor leagues. And then once you get to the big leagues, you can do whatever you want as far as hair and socks, because we had that rule too. It was crazy rules back then, man. But yeah, they just said, dude, you can do whatever you want once you get there. It's, you know, your game at that point. So that was a stride, you know, something we strove for to do, because we had to wear our pants up. We had to be clean shaven. We couldn't have long hair. It was like all these rules, and the goal was to get there so you didn't have any more rules, you know? You just played baseball.
That long hair was pretty identifiable, but when he cut it, man, he cleans up very nice.
He does, man. He's a good
He looks like
cat.
He's GQ walking down Madison Avenue when he cuts the hair. So yeah, it was pretty epic. And I was going to say to you too, I noticed, you know, you had the long hair going, and I was going to ask if that was kind of tied into everybody. It seemed like, you know, had that long hair at the time, but you know, obviously, when Jay came up, that was like they had the fake hair they were giving out to the fans. You know, it was pretty. That was pretty cool. But so when you got to rookie ball, you were in Kingsport, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So yep. You're there. So you go from being, you know, a Philadelphia kid. You get heading out to Kingsport for the first time. What's your first thought of rookie ball when you finally get the uniform on and cross the line?
It was not what I expected. I didn't know what professional baseball was going to be like, but I didn't think it was going to be like that. That felt more to me like a summer league. Like, you know, you go away to the Coastal Plains League and you're playing summer ball. It wasn't until later that year, my first year when I went to Brooklyn, that I finally realized like, wow, this is pretty awesome. You know, when you have 7,000 people screaming at you, Kingsport was probably 400, 500 people. So when you pitched bad, you could hear the one fan kind of heckling you, which was funny because both dugouts could hear them and that stuff. But once you got to Brooklyn, you didn't really hear them anymore. So it was definitely not what I expected, but, you know, I was still getting paid. It was very little, but it was really cool to set up a bank account and get paychecks and stuff like that. So it was definitely neat, but it wasn't what I had expected. And I couldn't imagine being in the GCL, you know, and starting my career there, where you're talking about three or four people watching a game and every game's at noon. So I was very fortunate I didn't have to do that. But yeah, it was definitely a little weird. I was expecting some big stadium and all these fans, and you know, it was like 400 people, but it was still a good experience. I was glad I got to go through it.
No, that's, of course, that's awesome. And the Brooklyn Cyclones, when they came in, I mean, that was like obviously a throwback to the connection that Brooklyn baseball has to baseball history. But here you are. Now you just started playing and you're only 2 hours from home. So, I mean, that's got to be cool too. You got to have your family probably come out and check out some of those early games of yours.
It was. I had family come down to Kingsport around my birthday, and actually like 2 weeks after I signed, when I got my first win, I had my mom. Like six of my college buddies were there. They all got to see me get my first professional win. And then, yeah, I go to Brooklyn. I'm 2 hours away. I was having people almost every weekend or every game, you know, from 9, 10, and 11, those 3 seasons I spent parked in Brooklyn. You know, I had family. It was almost like I was playing next door to home. You know, it was like every weekend was a home game. It was really cool.
The Brooklyn Cyclones have always been kind of ahead of the curve on certain things, especially how minor league baseball has evolved, and it's very promotional and it's very fan friendly. The Cyclones have always been really like on the cusp of all that, and like very, very innovative. The promotions they have are great, but you know, you also have that New York baseball lineage, which they can tie in very well. So when the Mets would kind of have those people come through to Brooklyn, as a fan, you're like, oh wow, I would love to go check out what's going down in Brooklyn, because there was a great connection between you know, the past Mets that would travel through as roving instructors. I remember going there. Daryl Strawberry was down there as a roving instructor. And it's just very cool. So how was the organizational tie-in with, you know, the big leagues being, you know, not that far from Brooklyn, and then how would they kind of integrate with the Brooklyn franchise?
It was so cool. They would, you know, every week that we were home, you know, somebody would be coming into town, and it would be, you know, big leaguers. I remember just off the top of my head, like John Franco, and then current guys. So like Dylan V came and threw the first pitch out one year and one game. And I was like looking at him thinking to myself, like, that's where I want to be. I want to be throwing the first pitch out at a Brooklyn game because I'm a starter on the big league team, or I'm a big league pitcher. Like, that's looking at those guys coming back, and like getting to talk to John Franco was awesome. Cause you know, he's a smaller guy. He's left-handed. It was like, he was what I wanted to eventually be, you know, either like a little lefty closer or something along those lines. But it was so cool getting to see all the people come through. I got to meet Keenan from Keenan and Kel. Like, he came and threw a first pitch, you know, and it was like awesome. But that full season in 11 when I was in Brooklyn was probably the most fun I've ever had. It was, like you said, they have so many tie-ins with being that close to Citi Field. And, you know, every single game there was some kind of promotion. And usually at the end of the month, we would get a bag full of all the promotions. So like if they did jerseys or whatever, it's actually the reason I switched. Now, I was 11 in college, number 11, but I switched to make sure I got number 11 in Brooklyn in 2011, because I knew every giveaway jersey would have my number on the back.
Oh, that's a good
call. So the year before I was number 10 because it was kind of the only number I could get. And I said, I'm going to get 11, because the year before, Daryl Siciliani was number 10. And my first day I got called up to Brooklyn, I said to Daryl, I'm like, yo, do all these people buy your jerseys? And he's like, no, man, that's just the year. And I'm like, oh, okay. So the next year I was like, I'm going to get 11. And wouldn't you know it, every giveaway, it looked like there was, you know, 5,000 TJ Tunnel fans. But really, they were just wearing the year. So yeah, it was awesome.
Look at you. You're a marketing whiz that early in your career. That's pretty damn astute of you. But you know, you went back and forth for the first 2 years of your career between Kingsport and Brooklyn. And then you spent the year in Brooklyn in 2011. Were you kind of getting to the point where you wanted to know where they saw you going from there? Were you thinking maybe going into 12, you might have a cup of coffee back in Brooklyn before you moved up? Or did you know going into the 2012 season that you'd be moving on to the next level?
I did. I knew the 2012. So what had happened was I had an okay year in 09 when I got drafted. And then in 10 spring training, I didn't make a full season team. They brought me in for the actual spring training. I didn't make a team. So I stayed and was going through extended spring training. And around that time, I was throwing hard, but I wasn't throwing strikes. So towards the end of extended, I basically said to my pitching coach at the time, Jonathan Hurst, who I had the year before in Kingsport, I said to him, like, will you play catch with me today? Because nobody else, you know, it was an odd number. So we were playing catch, and I dropped my arm slot from over the top to three quarters. And the ball was just jumping out of my hand. And he stops me, like, after, like, six throws. And he's like, Chiz, you doing something different? And I was like, yeah, man. Like, I just moved my arm slot down. It feels more comfortable. I'm able to throw more strikes. And he's like, well, let's get this approved, and, you know, we'll get you a couple bullpens, and you know, we'll run with this. So I said, all right. So the next day I get to spring training, and I'm expecting to see Chisholm bullpen. And it says Chisholm 2 innings in the game. Oh, and I'm wow. like, I have never thrown from this arm slot. But I was like, screw it. What do I have to lose? I honestly had wanted to quit. I hated baseball. I hated going to the field. It was just one of those times in my life that I didn't want to be there anymore. I wasn't moving. I wasn't getting better. And then I pitched 2 innings. I struck out 5 guys. And I'm like, you know what? That was fun. So the rest of extended, I did it again. You know, I was just pitching really well. And they sent me to Kingsport, which I understood, to kind of work on this arm slot. And I go back and I give up a run on opening night. And then I went 2.5 months and I didn't give up a run. They finally called me up to Brooklyn. Same thing. I pitched well. Did give up one of the furthest home runs in Brooklyn Cyclones history, which the announcer had been there since, you know, their first season, and he said it was the furthest ball he'd ever seen hit. But I was confident. I was having fun again. And then I go back there in 11 and had an awesome season, made the All-Star team. I had Frank Viola that year, which was a lefty, was a blessing to me. He was like my dad away from home. And he kind of took me under his wing. So when he was going to Savannah in 2012, I kind of had that feeling, you know, I'm coming off an all-star season. They're not going to send me back there. I'm going to make a full season team. And yeah, I broke camp with them. Funny story, Jake DeGrom did not break camp with Savannah that year. They held him back because he was coming off his Tommy John. They wanted to make sure he was ready. So I break camp with the team. It was awesome. and we start getting texts and calls from people back in extended spring training. And they say to us, DeGrom threw 100 today. And now I had just played with him in 10, and he was like 93, 94. So we're sending 100. I immediately text him, and I'm like, how are you throwing 100? And he texts me back. He goes, right before the start, I licked the ball. So I literally, the next day, before I go into pitch, I start licking the ball all over. I'm like, I'm throwing 100 today. I didn't, but had a great year. So Jake gets called up, you know, a couple weeks later. He comes to us, and he lives with me, and, you know, we had a great summer. He ends up getting called up at the All-Star break. I go to the All-Star game in 2012, and I'm the only one who goes back to Savannah. So TJ Rivera and Travis Tyrone, all three of us, we were the three that made it from the Sand Nats. And right. We all go to the All-Star game. Those two guys get called up. I'm leading the league in saves at the time, and I get sent back to Savannah, you know, after the All-Star game, just getting a bus, and I'm the only one going back. I'm like, this is unbelievable. So there's four games left. Now, I have my car packed. I am 100% going home. Like, I already made it up in my mind. Once we leave Kannapolis, we're going to go back to Savannah. I'm getting in my car, and I'm driving through the night going home. I was pissed that I had not been called up after, you know, essentially I finished second in the league in saves, but I was pissed. So 4 days left to go in the season. Luis Rojas, who's actually one of the five managers that's possibly in the mix, he calls me in his office and he says, TJ, what do you think about pitching in the playoffs? And I looked at him. I said, Louis, I don't know if you've checked the standings recently, but we're like eight games out with four to play. So we're not going to the playoffs. And he goes, no, not here in St. Lucie. And I was like, Louis, I'll be honest with you. I'm packed and ready to go. So send someone else. And he goes, well, they want our best pitcher and you're our best pitcher. I said, Louis, I was your best pitcher in June. I was your best pitcher in May. Like, why didn't they ask for me then? And he's like, well, they need you. They want a lefty specialist. So I just go in the outfield and I'm laying in the outfield. Frank comes out, you know, and he's trying to talk me into going and this and that. And I'm explaining it to him. I'm like, look, man, I just want to go home. Like, I had a great season. I really don't want to go there. My car's here, the whole nine. And he's like, just go. It'll be great for you. Great experience, blah, blah, blah. So I said, all right, I'll go. I go, and guess the only batter I face in the series, it was us against Jupiter in the first round. I came in to face one hitter, and it was Christian Yelich.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, two pitches, ground out to second base. And then Ryan Ellis, the manager, comes, gets me, says, Chiz, go sit down. That's why you're here, to get that lefty out. I said, all right, I go sit down. We ended up winning that game, and then we lost the next one, I think, to Jose Fernandez. He beat us, and they ended up winning the series. So I went home a couple days later, but I was glad that I ended up going.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you mentioned Frank Viola there, who I wanted to ask you about, who in his own right, you know, really blossomed with the Mets as a coach and had so many of the guys that ended up, you know, making it to the big leagues and so many guys that give him credit for a lot of the stuff. And you mentioned the kind of role he played with you. What was it about him as a coach that made him so much of a positive influence on the guys that were on the staff?
It was his mental approach and the way that he couldn't teach mechanics, and he'll be the first one to tell you that. He's not going to sit there and look at you and say, you need to put your hand here or do this. He's a mental guy. So you get to those higher levels where, you know, DeGrom and Max and Syndergaard, and they get to, it's not about stuff anymore. Everybody has good stuff in AA. It's that mental, being able to separate the mental part of the game from the physical part, and that's what he was able to do with us in the lower levels. And then that just carried on. You know, when he got to AAA, he was unbelievable at that. He understood that guys all have really good stuff. There's no getting around that. Every guy on every team is there for a reason, and that's because of his stuff. The guys that end up making it to the big leagues and flourishing are the guys that can mentally beat their opponent and mentally handle, you know, the ups and downs of 142 games. And he understood how to get that across to us. You know, at the time, did I know what he was doing for me or for the guys around me? Probably not. But, you know, looking back and being a coach for 4 years as a pitching coach, you know, that was kind of the angle I took. I could do a little bit more mechanically, I felt, but I also tried to tie in that mental part because that is, you know, we talk about it all the time about how mental the game is, and it's 90% mental, but there's not a ton of mental exercises that we do in the minor leagues or mental, you know, every team's getting into the mental coaches now because they're realizing this. But at the time, there wasn't a whole lot of mental things being taught, and he was able to do that for guys. And that's what made, you know, guys love him. And I'm so shocked that he has not gotten a big league chance. It's blown my mind. I still keep in contact with him till today. I was just talking to him a couple months ago about going to a Rockers game where he's coaching now. So, you know, we're still good buddies. I saw him at Max's wedding, and you know, we still keep in touch, but I'm just absolutely shocked that he has not gotten a chance.
Yeah, it's absolutely shocking. And as a fan, you watch this and you say, you know, he had all these guys, especially mm-hmm. you look at the 2015, 2016 years where we didn't know what to expect as fans out of that staff. Because really, I mean, you know, Jake came up and Jake was dominant. Then Mats came up in 2015. He was dominant. And it seemed like it was the perfect transition. And not to push anybody out of a job, obviously, Dan Worthen was the Major League pitching coach at the time. But are you surprised as a collective unit, as the guys in the minor leagues, that he's not getting that chance to be kind of pushed up to the top?
We were. I mean, I couldn't believe it, especially after, you know, he was in AAA in 14 and 15. And you just saw guy after guy going up. And, you know, there wasn't a ton to be excited about at the time. But the pitching was, you know, that was kind of the nucleus of how they were going to be good and how they were going to get to the World Series in 15 was with that staff. And he was the one that kind of developed them all. And, you know, Phil Regan is another one of my favorite guys in the world. So, like, him being there now, I think you saw the kind of turnaround once he got there.
Yeah.
Guys really love him and respect him. And he's very similar. He's a good mental guy. He's also excellent with mechanics. And that was the difference this year. I mean, you saw they've won 17 or 20 straight. I don't even know what it was once he got there. But those were two really good guys that were in the system. And you know, I know Terry had his Dan Worthen and all that stuff. But I think at some point, yeah, we were looking at it like, when are they going to get the opportunity to go win a World Series for this city kind of thing?
So where do you kind of fall in the, you know, mechanics versus analytics thing? Do you think that guys like a Phil Regan, now obviously I don't know, you know, what he does behind the scenes when it comes to, you know, the analytics stuff, but obviously that's the argument now with direction teams are going. But do you think it's more about what the guys' mechanics are and what the situations are versus, you know, percentage of this amount of pitch or percentage of, you know, all the factors that they have that factor in? Where do you kind of fall in that argument?
I'm in the old school, but you've got to be able to adapt. You know, there are things that these analytics show and these analytics, are going to, you know, eventually prove that you have to adapt to. You can't ignore it. You can't be, oh, you know, this is the way we do it. I'm old school and this is how I did it. Because yeah, guys have changed. Bodies have changed from when Phil Regan was pitching with Sandy Koufax. Times are different. Like, you're not going to get the same kind of results doing the same thing that you did 50 years ago. And that's what Phil's able to do. He's able to adapt. You know, he still sticks to his guns and there's things that he wants his pitchers to do. And if you do that, you know, you're going to be successful. And that's just a fact. And then he's able to kind of adapt and throw in those analytics. And yeah, what your job as a coach is to put your player in the best chance and best situation to be successful. So yeah, that's what the analytics do, right? They show you where this guy's most likely to hit the ball or where we're best off pitching this batter. And yeah, you have to use that, but that's not your end all be all. You're still going to go with the guy's strength, right? Your pitcher, he may be facing a guy who strikes out a ton or hits the ball to his pull side, but your pitcher can throw a slider on the outside corner, right? So you're going to go to your best pitcher strength. So I'm kind of in the middle. We can adapt, but there is a way that you like to have things done from an old school perspective. And you can't just be old school. You can't just be analytic. You've got
got to be a good mix.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, when I look at your numbers and you look at your, you know, your baseball reference profile and you see some of those, you know, those zeros up there, and I look at that and that's what I want to see when I look at a pitcher. I want to see, you know, what does he have when he's on the baseball card? You know, what is it looking at? And you had a very impressive minor league career, and you spent 2014 parts of that in Binghamton. You were also back down, I believe, were you back in St. Lucie at that point?
Yep.
Yeah, so
yep,
Binghamton and St. Lucie. So that was your last year with the Mets in minor league baseball before you'd move on to the Atlantic League. But what was it about that last year that kind of thought maybe, you know, my road is kind of ending here with the Mets organization?
Honestly, I never felt like it was. I felt coming out of camp, I was in 2014. I was so confident. I can't even tell you how confident I was. What happened? They asked me to go to Montreal that year for 3 exhibition games at the end of spring training. They only took 4 minor leaguers. Adam Kolarik was one who's since pitched in the big leagues with the Rays and Orioles. He was one, and I was one, and then there was 2 other players. There was only 4 of us asked. So I basically had like people flying out to Montreal. My dad overnighted my passport. I bought a $570 suit to wear onto the plane because we couldn't wear regular clothes and I didn't have a suit. So I was so excited to go to Montreal, get that big league experience. And Kyle Farnsworth was in the big league spring training and he had gotten released the last day. So that's basically whose spot I was taking to Montreal.
Okay.
And what had happened, they ended up telling Farnsworth to meet them in Montreal and they were going to sign him. I don't know if someone had gotten hurt or what it was, and I got called the day I show up with my suit and everything ready to go. Dickie Scott calls me in the office and he says, "Chiz, I hate to do this to you, but out of the 4 guys going to Montreal, you're the only one with a car, so we're going to hold you back. You're going to go the rest of spring training with minor league camp and then you're going to drive to Binghamton." And I can't tell you how disappointed I was. I had already told my family, my friends, everybody. And just to hear that kind of deflated me. It did make me find out that I had my carburetor in my car was, or whatever it was screwed up. So I wouldn't have made it. You know, I would have had to drive from St. Lucie to Binghamton by myself. Instead, I got to go with like 4 guys and I ended up getting my car fixed. So it was a blessing in disguise. But I go to Binghamton and my first outing was opening night. And I faced 2 lefties and a righty, and I went strikeout, strikeout, pop-up. I threw 7 pitches, struck out 2 guys, and now I hadn't thrown 2 innings all spring training. I was a 1-inning guy every 3 days. So I go to Binghamton, throw 1 inning. I sit on the bench. It's 45 degrees, and I say to myself, wow, I'm going to the big leagues. Like, that was easy. And Glenn Abbott, the pitching coach, comes up to me and he says, "Chiz, how do you feel?" And I'm not a guy that's going to say, "Oh, I'm done, coach." So I said, "I'm okay." And he said, "All right, you're going back out." So I go back out, walk, walk, double, 2 runs score. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. And basically, I didn't pitch for another week. Then I didn't pitch for another 11 days. I was just kind of like on the back burner. And by the time they sent me down, I was glad. I was like, good, get me out of here. I hate the cold. Let me go to St. Lucie. Let me get better. Like, let me fix whatever it is. And I did. I went. I got sent down right before the All-Star break. I sat with Phil Regan for 5 minutes, and we fixed exactly what it was. I ended up pitching like 12 great outings, and then the last 2 outings I got lit up a little bit. But I would have had a great season overall, even with my 8 ERA in Binghamton or whatever it was. And it ended up not being. It ended up being like a 5-something. And when I got the call that I got released, I was shocked. That is probably my only regret in baseball, is that when I got the call from Dickie Scott that I was being released, I didn't push harder to be like, why? Or, you know, what is your basis on this? Why are you releasing me after 5 good years? I had 1 bad 2 months, you know, like what is the basis for this? And it wouldn't have changed anything. They had already released me. It was already done. It wasn't like I was going to talk them out of it, but I do regret not pushing back a little bit and getting a few more answers. That's probably, it was shocking. I was such in shock that I basically said, okay, like I didn't know what to do. So it was weird.
So then what do you do? So do you get back on the horn and try to figure out, you know, with your people, what your next move is going to be? Like, what do you do following that phone call?
Yeah, basically I called my agent as soon as I hung up the phone and let him know. And his job was to get to winter meetings and to get me a job somewhere. And basically he was fighting for a few guys in our area that he represented. And it's hard to get back in, you know. It's with a guy I wasn't throwing hard. Very hard at the time. Like, it wasn't where I was drafted at. I was working at like 84, 85. But I could get people out, and that wasn't really what they were looking for. They were looking for that guy throwing 95 if they're going to take a chance on someone and bring him into camp. And I wasn't there at that time. So he got me the job. I wanted to play in Camden in the Atlantic League since it was close to home. It was kind of my first choice, and my agent talked me out of it. He's like, you know, you don't always want to be so close to home, because then you're going out and you're seeing, you know, people you shouldn't see. It might be better if you go to Somerset. They have better facilities, all that. So he did get me a job in Somerset. I enjoyed the 15 days I was there. They didn't enjoy it as much, I guess, and decided to either release me, or they said they can, you know, make it a trade. So I called Mike Costanzo, who was a buddy of mine playing on Camden, and he said, yeah, man, we had four pitchers get hurt. Come on over. So I actually didn't even talk to the actual manager. I talked to a guy on the team. And I showed up, and they basically told me, you know, you've got 2 weeks. Our pitchers are coming back at that point. We'll decide at that point if we want to keep you or not. And I ended up being like the first lefty out of the pen for the rest of the year. So it was a blessing in disguise. And yeah, I got to live at home with my dad, saved some money there. I made more money in the Atlantic League than I did at any point in my career in the Mets organization.
There you go. There's those Mets. There's a lot of rumors about why the Mets might be like that. But, you know, you mentioned your dad, and I wanted to mention him off the top, and I was just kind of thinking ahead. But your dad's also a former Major League Baseball player himself, so you're a second-generation ball player. He played for the Baltimore Orioles. So what was your dad like as a kind of a mentor for you as you were going through the minor league process?
He was great. I mean, when I told you about that season kind of in 10, when I wanted to quit, you know, he would talk to me. We talked after every game, for my entire career. And he would tell me, he would say there was points in my career where I wanted to quit, where I wasn't, you know, enjoying baseball anymore. And you just got to fight through it. It's going to get better. You know, growing up, him and my mom were unbelievable athletes, and they never pushed me to play baseball. They never forced me to do anything. I just kind of gravitated towards it. One thing that I try and tell young players is, and young parents of players, is that never tell your kid that he's the best. My dad never told me that I was the best player on the team. He would tell me that I was good and you know, I had a good game, but he always kept me hungry, and he always told me that there's someone else out there that's working harder than you are. That's what you have to strive for. You have to strive. Delaware County, where I grew up, is a bigger county for our area. But in the grand scheme of things, you know, he would tell me, you're just one small county in the whole United States that you are competing against. You're not just competing against these guys. And I saw that my first year. I'd go away, you know, when I signed, and every single guy there was an absolute stud in their county, in their state. You know, they're all Gatorade Players of the Year. They're all college All-Americans, every single guy. So, you know, once I saw that, I'm like, oh, you know what? He probably is pretty credible. So I started listening to more and more of his advice. But my mom, same thing. Like, she was great with everything. She would always be there if I was struggling and needed someone to talk to. And I was really blessed to have so many people kind of supporting me and rooting for me throughout. But yeah, that's something I definitely tell young parents, you know, keep them hungry. If you continue to tell them they're the best, they're probably going to get complacent and they're not going to work as hard. And when they do see that there's a lot of other baseball players in the country, it's going to hit them a little bit harder than if they were prepared for it.
Yeah, absolutely. And for those listening, his name was Tom Chisholm. He was an infielder for the Baltimore Orioles and played in 1979 for them. So that's pretty cool. You know, you're a pitcher, he's an infielder. So I guess that works when he can step in the box and kind of help you out from a batter's perspective. But kind of talk about what you did after you left professional baseball and what you're doing now. You're working with Adrenaline Fundraising based out of there in Philadelphia. But kind of explain to listeners and fans what it is you're up to these days.
Yeah, so these days I just got done coaching last year. I was at Widener University. I pretty much, when I was finished in the Atlantic League, we finished in September, and by like December, January, I was reached out to by the head coach at Widener, Mike LaRosa, and he asked me if I'd be interested in the pitching coach job. So I knew I wanted to stay in baseball, and I did that for 4 years. I loved it. Unfortunately, assistant coaches in D3 baseball don't make a ton of money. And I was kind of looking to take that next step with my girlfriend at the time. So we kind of made a decision that I was gonna take this fundraising thing head on, and I was excited about it. I had a ton of connections in the baseball world, and I'm still technically a coach, so it's pretty cool. You know, I get to sit down with baseball coaches in the area, or any sport really. I work with football, I work with lacrosse and soccer, and basically just raise money for their athletic programs. You know, coaching at Widener kind of opened my eyes a little bit to how much fundraising goes on, not just in college sports, but high school sports. And anything I could do to help a high school coach not have to worry about fundraising, that's kind of my job. I come in and take over the whole thing for him, and I just hand him a bag of money at the end of our fundraiser, and you know, he gets to focus on coaching and getting his team better, and you know, I get to do something that I love to do at the time. So it's going well.
That's very cool. Yeah, and I'm really glad we were able to connect and talk about this, because, you know, again, as a fan, and this was not what I was setting out to do, was just go right to the Mets organization and talk about players that I was reading about, you know, a couple years ago. So I really appreciate you sharing all that, and this has been a lot of fun. And, you know, before we wrap up, if you want to share with the listeners of Diamond Conversations, you know, where they can find you or what's going on in the world of TJ Chisholm, please do so. The floor is yours.
Yeah, man, I appreciate you having me on. I had a blast. Yeah, I got just on Twitter at teaches, I believe 11. And yeah, I don't use Twitter a ton, but that's where I like to get my news. But that's where you can find me. Other than that, man, I'm just enjoying life at the moment. I've got a 3.5-month-old daughter that is the love of my life. So we, me and my fiance Sarah, are enjoying every second we get with her. So it's been a great retirement.
Fantastic. Before we let you go, we got to know. So what do you think? We're approaching game three here. Who do you got winning the 2019 World Series?
The Nats, man. They're hot. They're hot. And you'd rather run into a better team that's not hot than a hot team. And they are hot right now. So I've got to say the Nats in five.
Okay, we'll agree to disagree, even though, like I said earlier, I'm taking aside my rooting interest for this series. I just want it to be over. So I'll just leave it at that. But TJ, I really, I appreciate it. This has been a lot of fun, and thank you very much.
Yeah, man, thank you.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well, by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. And we want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture.